Worship and Spiritual Formation was presented by Nancy Scott on October 11, 2003 at the 2003 Oktoberfest conference titled Reflections on Spiritual Formation. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
We're going to continue our theme of reflecting on spiritual formation. Our next teacher, next session, is going to be led on the subject of worship and spiritual formation by Nancy Scott. Nancy has been on the staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College for a goodly number of years, since 1991, somewhere in that area. She has graduate degrees in science, in biology, and more recently in as a licensed family and marriage counselor and therapist here in town, has a practice. She teaches for us, she writes for us, and she does a whole bunch of stuff behind the scenes working with students in very unseen but very important ways. So we're really delighted to have her. So, Nancy.
Thank you. It's good to be here. As David said, maybe he didn't say it this way, but this is a work in progress. I've rewritten this talk several times over the last few days, including this morning. in the end, I think it's going to be kind of a personal reflection of some ideas and experiences that I've had, and I hope that it ends up with some cohesiveness, some coherence along the way. Excuse me. Oh, and I just want to make one correction to Wes's introduction. I'm not actually yet licensed. I took my exam a few weeks ago, but I haven't heard yet. So, but I do work as a counselor and therapist. Occasionally, I go to the Episcopal Church. I enjoy the reverence of the service. I didn't grow up Episcopal. I grew up actually not going to church much at all, except for Easter and Christmas. That was the kind of family I grew up in. And then as a teenager, I became a Christian and got involved in evangelical churches, which very much distanced themselves from any kind of the liberal churches like the Episcopal Church. So when I go now, I kind of go with a fresh, I don't have a lot of baggage coming along with me, so that might be part of why I can enjoy what happens in the Episcopal Church. But I appreciate the reverence of it and the symbolism of the liturgy. When I go, it gives me an occasion to focus for an hour on who God is, who I am. It's a profound and very beautiful reminder to me of some very essential truths. And I really appreciate that. So one day recently, actually this summer when I was on my way home from the Episcopal Church, I was struck by the service I had just attended, and I was thinking about Jesus' encounter with the woman at the well and his comment to her that when she's kind of, if you remember the story, she's trying to distract him into this conversation about what church looks like rather than have him peer into her heart on some level. And he replies to her that one day we will worship in spirit and in truth, that it won't matter where we do it, which mountain, but that we will have, I think what he was getting at is that we will have hearts that understand who God is and who we are on such a deep level that it won't matter what we're doing together because we're going to get it. And so I was just struck by that and kind of longing for that, longing for maybe a unity that I don't see because we all have such different tastes and desires, and so often we get into these very, I think, in some ways destructive patterns of critiquing what we do together rather than kind of just being together and believing something together. So we can get caught up in talking about what church ought to look like rather than what we believe together. So I started thinking about that, and I started thinking about Paul in the New Testament and what his perspective was on this stuff and wondering about that. And I was thinking, you know, I don't see Paul encouraging the first century Christians to be Jewish. I mean, it seems like if he was going to encourage them to be religious on some level, that would be the one to pick, because, you know, after all, God handed this religion to them, and so certainly that would be the one that God would pick. But I don't really see Paul doing that in the New Testament. So I have to sort of conclude that maybe religion wasn't really that essential from Paul's perspective, and that that having the right religion wasn't that important to Paul either. What was important to Paul was having the new church understand grace. And he spends a lot of time in the book of Romans talking about the difference between law and grace. And I think coming out of his Jewish background and presenting the gospel to a largely Jewish culture who had just experienced all this stuff that had happened with Jesus and was all trying to figure out what all that meant, he spends quite a bit of time in the book of Romans talking about distinguishing between law and grace. And in the end, I think one of his main distinctions between those two things is that the law was this way that the Jews were given that on some level qualified them for grace, or they had this perspective that their religion qualified them in a unique way for what God was doing. And that grace is a whole different operating system. It's not the same at all. That in fact, the gospel of Jesus is fundamentally God doing something in us rather than us qualifying ourselves for God in some way. So this was a really huge change and a huge distinction. And I think in essence it's why Paul didn't talk a lot about religion, because religion was this way of, I think, in the ethos of the culture then, was this way of qualifying ourselves. And I think we can still get mixed up with that and see religious services or religious practices as a way that we are making ourselves pleasing to God, or that there's a way that we are relating to God that he is one way he's more pleased with than another. And that's the part that I want to kind of throw up and look at and say, maybe not. Maybe that's not really the point. If the gospel of grace is the point that Paul is getting at, then what does real worship look like? We've had a couple talks already that have clarified sort of this idea that God is this very big God who is using anything and everything in our lives to call those who are his own to himself, and to... I loved David's dental hygienist metaphor that he uses all kinds of things in our lives to pick at what needs to be cleaned out. And that's the process, really, of grace, because it's not something that I do that gets him to do that. It's his decision to come after me that I see working out in how I respond, even to, do I want that part picked at or not? Well, in the end, my heart ends up broken, and I want that. That tells me that God is at work here. So, again, looking at the book of Romans, I also went to chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, which is a passage that I memorized when I was about 13, I think, for the first time. And I can still recite it in probably two or three different translations, versions. But I don't think I really knew what it meant until a little bit further, way further down the road in my own life, and kind of looking at it a little bit differently. So I'm going to read the passage, and then I'm going to talk about it for just a second. Or should I recite it? What do you think? No, just kidding. I have it written down in front of me. I urge you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I think it's one of those verses that is so commonly referred to that we kind of have this idea that we know what it means without ever really thinking about it. And I think that was my experience with this verse, because I said it for so long and recited it for so long that never necessarily thought about what it really meant. But in the context of the book, again, as Paul has laid out this difference between law and grace, and he's really focusing on what grace is and what this gospel is about, he's actually, in the process of that book, he gets to this spot where he says, therefore, brethren, I urge you. So he's saying, in light of this gospel that I've just outlined, in light of understanding grace, what is my response to it? And he's saying that my response, he's kind of making it a contrast between the sacrifices that they might have thought were appropriate coming out of their Judaism to the sacrifice that he's saying is more appropriate in light of the mercy of God, and that is that my life becomes my sacrifice. That my life lived pursuing God, seeking God, believing God is really what is called on for me in terms of worship. So true worship, rather than being a ritual or a practice, excuse me, is actually living a life that betrays my deep inward belief in God. Not a particular practice or a particular religion, but a posture, an attitude of my life that understands grace at its core. Okay, so that's my my thesis, if you will, that true worship is living a life that betrays my deep inward belief in God. Not a particular practice or right religion, but rather a posture of my life, an attitude of my life, that understands grace, that understands that it's God who's doing something inside of me, and then I respond with particular practices or whatever that might be meaningful to me. So in Jack's diagram last night, I'll also point you to that. It's, I don't have it in front of me, but it was, there were boxes everywhere. There were a lot of boxes. And I remember the boxes. And I remember that practices and results were two of those boxes. And in several of these ways, oh, thank you. I might be able to count the boxes without, no. Yeah, so anyway, yeah, practices and results are the two different, in the first three ways that Jack is looking at this, practices are on this side and results are on this side. And in his biblical view, it turns out that results are on this side and practices are on this side. That, I think, is what is the key difference in understanding grace versus understanding law. And so any practice, I want to go on to say that I think any practice that comes out of an understanding of the grace of God being active in my life can be a valid, appropriate practice. So long as what I am understanding is that the result of God's grace is actually preceding that practice. So I'm not doing something to get God to work in a certain way. I'm not performing a ritual or an observance or a personal form of any kind to get God to act, but rather because God has acted, I find certain things meaningful. And as such, they are helpful reminders to me of what's really true, and they help me in my walk with God to be reminded of truth and to continue to hang on to the promises of the gospel that God, by invading my life, has brought me to understand. So practices themselves do not serve to please God or to get God to act in a different way. Rather, practices that serve to remind me of the reality of who God is and who I am can serve to encourage my faith and also reflect my humanness. So there's beauty in the world. When God gives us eyes to see who he is and who I am, I actually can see all kinds of things in a different way. It's almost like living in black and white and then all of a sudden having the channel turn to color, perhaps. So I actually want to go further and say that not just any practice could be valid in this way, but actually any experience. And I think David alluded to this, that God uses all kinds of things in our lives to remind us of who He is and who we are. And in that sense, I think worship, because remember, worship is living a life that understands grace. It's reflecting this deep commitment that I have. Any experience that I have, whether it's planned or unplanned, can serve to remind me of who I am before God and what God is up to in the world and in my life. I think that it's the posture toward any given practice or experience that is what God is getting at and what matters, not the practice itself as a right way or a wrong way to relate to God. So practices are not particularly helpful or valid. In fact, they can be misleading if their goal is to gain favor with God or if their goal is to get God to act in a certain way in my life. But any practice or experience can be helpful or valid if it simply reminds me of what is true as its goal. And we need reminding. I think one thing that we see in the Old Testament is God continually reminding Israel who He is and who they are, and offering. I love the different places where they go through an experience and God says, set up some memorial stones, remember this. And that serves as a reminder of God's faithfulness and also of His involvement in their process and his direction in what's happening with them. And it also seems to me that one of the tensions that this brings up is that we have in our fallenness, I think, this tendency to really want to make sure we're okay with God. And so we go about doing different things to try to make sure we're okay with God. And I think this also addresses that if we really understand grace, we don't have to do stuff that's making sure we're okay with God. We have to understand our hearts and cry out to Him and want repentance. And the very fact that that's true of me is evidence that God is drawing me and working and present in my life. In my own experience, I want to tell a story of when I first became a Christian. I, as I said, I memorized a lot of Bible verses in my early years. I actually left faith entirely for several years. When I became a Christian again in my late 20s, I was very surprised, for one thing, that the way that came about was, many of you have heard me tell this story, but I was a very confirmed atheist and was biologist and was very convinced that time, chance, matter was all we needed, and to explain everything around us. And anyway, I had this Christian coworker who I did a lot of field work, fishing. I was in fish biology, and it was a really great job. I got to fish for a living. But during a lot of this field work, there would be time spent driving from river to river or whatever, and I had this Christian coworker, and we would often be in the team in the truck together or something, and he would get into these conversations, and I loved trying to, like, pin him to the wall and make him feel foolish or, like, tell him how ridiculous it was that he believed what he believed. And he was a nice enough guy. I was really mean to this guy. God bless him. But he was, you know, he just kind of kept saying stuff. And I, at one of these trips, I just decided, one thing was I knew the Bible pretty well, so I could kind of nail him on stuff because, you know, if he wasn't really thinking about it or consistent, then look out. But anyway, I thought, you know, I'm going to have to get the Bible out because I know he's wrong about this one thing. Or something, I don't know. So one Saturday between trips, I pulled out a Bible and started looking up stuff kind of for ammunition for this guy. And that was how God invaded my life, was I opened the Bible on this one Saturday and just went, oh my gosh, what if this is true? I think I'm going to have to do something about this. And I was the last person who wanted to believe this stuff or wanted to say I was going to follow God. It was really upsetting to be kind of confronted with this reality that maybe this is true. And so I kind of like kept reading and I snuck into the back of the church the very next day, kind of thinking, well, if, you know, maybe that's where God is or something. Maybe I'm going to like find out something if I go to a church. So anyway, long story, but it was very clear to me that God initiated my journey with him. Because in my particular story, I had nothing to do with it, and it was really clear. As I went along, though, it didn't take very long before the various Christians that I found myself around and the couple of different churches that I ended up going to, that I kind of picked up this idea that I should be doing certain things, and that, and in my own heart, I was so thankful that God had kind of, you know, snatched me up out of my utter blindness, that I wanted to do anything I could to repay that in some way, or to express my gratitude to him, that kind of thing. And so I just went out with a fervor to do whatever they told me I ought to be doing. And I ended up reading, I would read different biographies of Christian leaders like Jim Elliot and various missionary figures who were just, you know, had these amazing experiences. And I wanted to know, you know, like, I wanted my life to be like theirs somehow. And so I found that, in particular, it was Jim Elliot's story who had seen a real change in his life when he decided to have a devotional time that was like, I don't know, 45 minutes or an hour long each morning. He talked about how that had changed his life. So, well, I didn't need any more convincing. I went about disciplining myself to get up an hour early every morning, and I did that for a few years, believe it or not, and I'm not a morning person, so it's hard to imagine. But I had this experience of this being what God wanted of me, and it was colliding with this other experience that I'd had, that God was pursuing me and that he was in charge of the salvation. And they kind of conflicted, because more and more the stuff that I was doing was stuff that I thought was going to get me maturity faster, or that was going to get me an experience of God that was different, or I don't know. Do you know what I mean? And so these two things were colliding anyway for me. On the one hand, I knew that the salvation was God's, because I didn't want it in the first place when he showed up in my living room. But now it was like it was up to me. And I felt more and more, I felt this pressure to do it right and to figure out how to do it and all this stuff. And so that was a real collision in my world. And finally, when I began to understand that I was having this collision, I was really struck again in the book of Romans when Paul says something, I don't remember what chapter it's in now, it's either 5 or 8, anyway, where he says, while we were still enemies, we were reconciled with God. But having now been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. And I thought about, yeah, that's me, because I was certainly his enemy when he came into my living room that day. I didn't want anything to do with him. What's different now? Well, what's different now is that he's dragged me onto his side. And now I'm on his side. And so what's different other than that? Well, not really anything, because he's still the one dragging me. And the longer I live and the more I see my heart, I understand that even though I'm doing all this stuff and it looks really good, it's like I have this heart inside of me that is so in need of being fixed on such a deeper level than what I do on the outside. And so that was kind of my experience of having to finally decide, what about these practices I'm doing? And I had to give it up. And I had to give it up because I had to find out what was true about who was in charge of my sanctification, just like who was in charge of my salvation to begin with. And it was a very profound experience for me that I stopped doing my devotional time. it was very frightening, to be honest. I thought I was going to go off of a cliff. And I, in fact, I thought that certainly I wouldn't be a Christian 6 months later. And I say that with a real graveness, because that was a very real fear. Because I had walked away once before. I had ditched it years before. I knew that was an option, and I was afraid of it. So I had to find out what was true. And I found out that that wasn't what my soul depended on. That in fact my soul depended on God and not on me. So that was really good news. So many years later, I find myself not really having much of a practice of any kind, and yet still hungry to know who God is and to understand his work in my life and in my heart. And I see that as evidence of this reality, that God is the one pulling me, dragging me sometimes toward himself and into the kingdom. And that's really good news. And there's incredible freedom in that. There's a freedom that says, it's not up to me. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit now and talk about, so what about worship? I'm supposed to be talking about worship here. I was kind of talking about personal worship because that's what my devotional time was. And I think we definitely live in a culture where we really, there's a lot of Christian culture out there that focuses on personal worship as well as corporate worship as something that is required of us in some way. So remember, in our fallenness, we have this inclination to want to make sure we're okay with God. And also remember, true worship is living a life that betrays my deep inward belief in God. So I want to put those two things together. This freedom that I'm talking about, I think, is also relevant to any kind of experience I might have. So it doesn't have to be a religious practice. I'm now free to either lay down religion or to pick it up. And I'm free to understand any kind of religious or even mundane experience in terms of God teaching me, God drawing me to himself. Because remember, true worship is living a life that betrays my deep inward belief. And that's worship. So it seems to me that it really matters which side the boxes go on, where the results and the practices line up together. That the results come first, the practices come later. I think the same is true for our experiences, that any experience that we might have in the mundaneness of our lives can be used by God to show us who he is, who we are, and what's true about our lives. And that's the process, that's the journey that he has us on all along the way. So any practice or experience can actually have a cause and effect kind of relationship in providing for my growth, my spiritual formation. Doesn't have to be a religious practice. It could be the mundane. I had a friend this week who told me about an experience that she had of rearranging her bedroom furniture. And she had this incredible desire to redo her bedroom, and she did that. But she had this a lot of energy about it going on, and she decided that she needed to buy a new piece of furniture for it. So she went out and spent more money than she really had to spend on it, and then got it home and got this great, beautiful bed home and thought, why did I do this? What's going on here? And it caused her to really think about some of the struggles that she was having, and she thought through it a little bit, and over some time, it took maybe even a week or two before she was kind of putting it together, but she realized that that her parents, well, she had lost her mother as a child, and she had these really fond memories of Sunday mornings climbing into bed with her parents when they were reading the paper, and that was like this really big deal for her. And there had been some other events in her recent life that had kind of brought up the loss of her mother and kind of had reminded her of that stuff. But you know how life is really busy and you kind of just keep skating right on by whatever's happened because the urgency is right there. And so anyway, what she ended up realizing was that this whole process of needing to rearrange her bedroom and buy this new bed that she really couldn't afford was so much about her longing for something that she didn't have anymore. And something that she really longed for was a connection with her mother. And it caused her to have this opportunity to kind of be with God about that and just say, I don't have that. And recognize that that's what her life looks like. And recognize that that's what today she's called to trust God with. And so it was actually quite a religious experience for her, if you will, that that she bought this bed that she couldn't afford and that she had this opportunity to reflect on what was behind it for her. And it was like God was saying, you know, it's hard to be here now and home is somewhere else. And for her it was, and I can wait for that and I need to wait for that and just be with my longing and trust and believe God in the midst. So remember, true worship is living a life that betrays my deep inward belief. This is what worship was for her in that day. So it can be a mundane experience as much as it can be a religious experience or a spiritual activity. Okay. There are a couple of implications of what it is I'm trying to say here. And I haven't really stuck with what I've written down because, like I said, it was a work in progress. But I'm going to take a minute to look and see if I'm forgetting anything that I really wanted to say. Okay, I'm going to read this paragraph. The existential inward choices that we make, not whether we have a particular experience of God, are what God uses to grow us up. I am not responsible to achieve a certain experience of God. I am responsible to make choices that reflect what I say I believe. So as I stumble around trying to seek God in the midst of mundane or ceremonial life, God breaks in along the way and grows me up. That said, I think that we don't need to measure our faith on the basis of some experience, some subjective experience of God, because each of us has a different experience of God based on our different personalities and our life experiences. The relationship that we have with God will be as unique as our fingerprints. So, as I looked at Jim Elliot's life and see what God used with him, I wanted it to prescribe what I should do. And I think that's where there was a mistake, because that was him and this is me, and God is doing stuff with me that he's not doing with him, and God is doing stuff with him that he's not doing with me, and we're different, and I think that that's okay. So and I think that we can really get caught up in trying to, because remember, in our fallenness we really want to make sure we're okay with God. So we can get into these ideas of, well, this is what their life looked like. This is what they're doing on Sunday morning. Maybe that's the key. Maybe this is what will change my life, this kind of thinking. And so we grab onto some practice, and we want it to be prescriptive of our lives. But they're really not. And I think we can encourage one another very much as we describe our experiences to one another. But they can be descriptive, not prescriptive. And in such, we remind each other and we encourage each other. So the real evidence for the work of God in our lives as believers is not the quality of our emotional experience of God or the quality of our worship experience, but rather that over the course of our lives, our choices reflect what we believe. True worship is living a life that betrays my deep inward belief in God. So there's another implication here. That is that we don't need to measure our faith on the basis of a subjective experience of God. We also don't need to measure each other's faith on such a basis. So one of the implications of this is that I don't impose my personal religious preferences onto my brothers and sisters. So if I find a particular practice meaningful, I don't presume that it will mean the same thing to my friends. Romans 14, I think, addresses this. Paul goes on in his book. I'm just going to read a couple of verses there. One man has faith that he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats vegetables only. Let not him who eats regard with contempt him who does not eat, and let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has accepted him. For who are you to judge the servant of another? To his own master he stands or falls, and stand he will, for the Lord is able to make him stand. So ultimately, what we find meaningful and how God uses various tools to chip away at the tartar of our lives, it's between me and God. It's between you and God. If God is in charge of getting you there, God is in charge of getting me there, and in some kind of wonderful gift way, he's actually bringing us there together at times. And so we can encourage one another as we walk together and as we are on this journey together. But we don't have to decide what you ought to be doing or what I ought to be doing to make it look a certain way. And I think there's a lot of freedom in that too. Okay, so back to religion. So one more implication. I'm also aware there's an implication that of this view that my religious practices will have no intrinsic value before God. So remember, we have this inclination that we want to be okay with God. We want to know that. And so anything that I do, I think I'm going to kind of see myself slide toward wanting it to tell me something about whether I'm okay with God. And I think that's just a caution that we kind of do that. And so let's just kind of be aware of that and say, oh yeah, remember, true worship is living a life that betrays my deep inward belief in God. It's not something I'm going to do to get God to behave in a certain way toward me. And that's the distinction. So, back to some examples. I mentioned earlier that I enjoy the Episcopal service. Margaret mentioned earlier about her Catholic experience and the church calendar. And I'm very aware that I personally have kind of visceral reactions to certain things that I did grow up with, practices that I don't find meaningful anymore. And I have this real welcoming of practices that I didn't grow up with. So this is part of the subjectivity that I'm talking about. I mean, we just kind of all have different experiences, and some things are going to be poignant reminders. Some things are just going to be like, get me out of here. But I think, you know, God is doing a lot of different things in a lot of different places, and I think that that's okay. So for me, the Episcopal service has become quite meaningful, and I've gone, it started several years ago when I started going to Midnight Mass just once a year to the Catholic Church. I switched, this is how free I think we really are, I switched to the Episcopal because the Catholics don't really like it if you partake of the Eucharist if you're not Catholic. So, and the Episcopals are okay with any baptized Christian partaking. And so that got me. But anyway, there's a couple things in the service that are particularly profound to me that I just wanted to talk about. And this is just my own experience, but I'm thinking that you guys might have similar experiences or a different kind of experience in a different context. So just as an example, I actually find the church calendar to be quite poignant. And after I went at Christmas time for a long time, I started going at Easter time. And I actually still only go mostly those two times a year. I don't really go that often in between. But I find that some of the ways that Scripture is read are particularly meaningful to me. I also understand that I have spent a lot of time trying to understand what the Bible is saying. And because I bring with me what I hope is an informed understanding of what the Bible is saying, the readings can take on a real meaning. I don't know what it's like to sit there after having been in Catholic school and have them mean a mishmash of things, and I think that would be really unfortunate to not have them mean what they really mean as you hear those stories. But in my experience, as an example, the Easter Vigil that happens in the Episcopal calendar, the night before Easter Sunday, they have what they call a solemn High Eucharist and Easter Vigil. And many of you have probably been to a service like this. They're very standard, of course. They're in the Book of Prayer, and they've been practiced this way, I guess, for centuries, which is also something that's kind of profound to me, that God has been kind of... these symbols have kind of stayed alive for people down through the centuries, and who knows what they've meant over the years to different people, but somehow or another, God has preserved this thing. So anyway, they just read they just read scripture, have the choir sing a chorus, and then have a prayer. And they do that like four or five times during this vigil. And the scriptures that they read are the different deliverances, because this is Easter, which commemorates the greatest deliverance. And so they start with the story of the flood and Noah and read that story. And then there's a choir, a chorus that's sung, and a prayer that's prayed. Then they move on to, I believe next is the story of Abraham and Isaac and the deliverance that God gave when the ram was found, instead of God having Abraham sacrifice Isaac. Then a song is sung and a prayer is prayed. The next one is, I believe, Moses and the Red Sea, and when God delivered the people out of the hand of the Egyptians. The one after that is the story in Ezekiel of the dry bones, which the first time I was there, I thought, that is so random. But what a powerful story that God takes Ezekiel to this vision of where these dry bones are and puts life into them. Whoa. That's pretty powerful. And then he goes on to the story of Jesus and the crucifixion and the resurrection. And then this is all done in the dark, and the lights go on, and Easter begins to be celebrated. And it's a very beautiful and powerful symbol and reminder of this deliverance that God has brought to us in Jesus. So it's that kind of thing that, for me, can be very, very poignant and very meaningful. It's not for everybody. And there are a lot of folks in our community who wouldn't have any interest in doing that and wouldn't find that to be meaningful at all. But I think there are also ways that we experience life, like buying furniture for a bedroom that we've rearranged without knowing what the energy is about it. I have another story like that where recently I had a cat who had a student renter who was living at my house and packed up to move away and inadvertently packed my cat into the trailer. You've heard about curiosity killing the cats. Well, in this way, curiosity relocated the cat. But hopefully it didn't kill her. But anyway, it was very upsetting. I mean, all of a sudden my cat was relocated to another part of town. And so I went down every day for probably a week, and I went at different times of the day thinking, you know, well, she'll hear me calling her. You know, one day, finally, about 5 or 6 days into it, I don't remember, I went at the crack of dawn because I thought, you know, she's going to be like prowling around right at sunup maybe, and I'll find her. So I looked for her at dawn, and I was really discouraged because I'd been doing this for days and no Tilly. And so I finally, there was a chair in front of somebody's empty apartment down in this neighborhood, and I sat down in this chair, just kind of waited, thinking. And I started having this conversation with God, and it was kind of one of those conversations where I was like, okay, God, you know where she is. Why can't you just bring her to me? You know where I am. You know where she is. Make it work. You know, come on. You can do this. You ever have, you know, probably don't ever have those kind of conversations with God. So anyway, as I sat there and he wasn't doing it, I was just kind of aware that he wasn't doing it. And I was kind of frustrated about that. And then it kind of, again, occurred to me, oh, he's God. He gets to decide. He gets to decide whether Tilly comes back to my home or not. And he gets to decide what happens to Tilly. And he gets to decide what happens to me. And it ended up being this very profound recognition of how hard it is to let that be true and how hard it is to trust him with just this little cat who was, you know, this little cat. She was a stray when she showed up. I just really loved her. And God watches out for the sparrows, the Bible says. So I know he cares about Tilly on some level. And yet, I don't know what that means. It could mean that she starves to death, quite honestly. It could mean that she's already been hit by a car. It could mean any number of things. But you know what? He's God, and she's His. And the same thing is true in my life. And it's really hard to know that sometimes. So God uses all these different experiences. He uses all these different things to remind us who He is and who we are. And true worship is living a life that betrays my deep belief in God. So over time, over the course of my life, I see God refocusing my attention to Him in the course of either a mundane experience or a ceremonial experience, either one. And there's beauty everywhere. God, in the midst of this crazy life that's full of pain and difficulty and longing and hanging on for the kingdom, has peppered it with beauty. And I think that we need to know that too and accept it and look around and see the colors and pause every now and then and be reminded that God is so good and He's so generous with us. I don't know if you've seen a rainbow lately, but rainbows are amazing. I mean, it's like, not to mention what they meant somehow back there when Noah first heard about them, but gosh, they're just beautiful. And I don't know about you, but I've moved to the Northwest within the last 15 years. Where else I've lived in the country, they don't have rainbows like this. You guys have some, we have great rainbows here. So anyway, there's beauty in a conversation. There's beauty in living this life. There's beauty in pausing to see who God is and how He's drawing us to Himself. So, true worship is living a life that betrays my deep inward belief in God. Thank you. Questions? Thoughts? Hi, Roger. Thanks.
I actually have two questions that people would also need to do. First, Ian says that true worship is to help the widows and orphans.
True religion.
True religion.
Yeah.
Does that figure into your interpretation of Romans 12, where it talks about living out?
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
Mm-hmm. I certainly think it can. I haven't looked at that passage in a while in James, but certainly if true worship is living a life that betrays my inward belief in God, one of the outworkings of that could very well be a care and concern for the needy, for people who aren't as fortunate as me, for the widows and the orphans. I think that what I didn't mention is Romans 12 goes on to talk about different ways that life looks for in this implication of a renewed mind, a renewed life, and what that looks like. Wes is actually going to talk about that some this afternoon in his talk on service, and I think that could very well come in at that point. But yeah, I think it's definitely consistent.
My second question involves your statement that you said your Tilly experience. Would you have come away with, you concluded that from your Tilly experience that God had Tilly and He had you. Would you have come to that same conclusion 20 years earlier? And do you think the Tilly experience intrinsically has that wisdom as part of it, or did you bring that wisdom to your Tilly experience?
That's a good question. I don't know. I seriously doubt I would have had that experience 20 years ago. I did have another experience with a different cat 10 years ago that was quite different. But it also took me toward understanding that God was in charge. So I don't know, it might be a chicken and the egg kind of thing in terms of our experience, because our experiences bring us that wisdom, I think. And the wisdom that we bring then informs our experience. Does that make sense? So it's kind of both, maybe.
Well, thank you for your talking about worship, and it's our core belief. And Romans 12, 1 and 2 is our theme at our children's school this year, and Living God Loud, so I appreciate that. Two questions. Could you talk about corporate worship and its importance? And then what about the sacraments, the Lord's Supper and baptism, and how do they fit in?
Okay. Those are good questions. I think that corporate worship is kind of, in our culture anyway, can have the same sort of meaning that I was bringing to my personal worship that I was talking about, that we need to do certain things together. And often the experience of various forms of corporate worship can be kind of a, maybe not a going after, I want to know that I'm okay with God, but maybe in a corporate way, we kind of want to know that we're a body, that we're kind of inviting God in some way, that he might not come if we don't get our hearts in a certain posture or something like that. And I find that to be, I think, pretty misleading. How long do I have, by the way? When am I supposed to stop? 10 till? Probably won't go that long. But I think that what we do together as believers in our bodies, in our local bodies of believers, is also really optional and really can look a lot of different ways. I think that it's unfortunate that we too often get caught up in how we do church, how we do worship becomes the dividing line, rather than what is it that we're really believing together about the gospel. And I would encourage us to take that kind of mindset into our churches much more than we do. Now you asked also about the sacraments. I think there's been a lot of historical precedent for understanding the sacraments to be some kind of means of grace. And I would consider that that's not accurate in terms of Paul's understanding of what grace is. So where the sacraments have been seen, I think, historically as a way that I prepare myself for receiving grace, or that I, and even in the liturgy in the Episcopal Church or the Catholic Church, for example, the Mass itself is seen as a means of grace. So that's why it's required, or like a mortal sin, to not go, or it used to be anyway. Help me out here, Margaret. Okay, me too. So anyway, I don't think that that's accurate, because I think that, again, that's getting the boxes in the wrong order, where the practice comes before the targeted result, which is God's grace coming in. I think God's grace is coming in here, but in this picture with the boxes in the right order, I think the sacraments can be a profound reminder of what is true. Same with baptism. If baptism is a picture that is helpful to me, or that it has certain cultural significance or meaning about starting life over or confessing a belief, I think that can be incredibly meaningful. But I don't think it's a way that we get to a certain place. And that's the distinction that I want to make. Is that helpful? Other questions or comments?
Well, I'm hoping I can formulate this question. So bear with me. Okay, so if you mentioned a group, not a group, you mentioned that we should not impose our practices on others. And then you also talked about the Romans 14 passage where Paul uses the two words for one group, you know, do not have contempt, mm-hmm. and do not judge. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could help me think about my own response. So if I'm encountering somebody saying that these practices are necessary, and it can be found in many different groups, help me think about how to respond to that. I guess it sort of seems like with the Romans 14 passage that the person who has the encouragement from Paul not to have the contempt for the other is the one who is having the other side impose a practice of some sort, or impose an avoidance. Mm-hmm. And I just, it's good for me to be reminded of that, and I was just wondering if you could say any more about that to help me remember more about what Paul's trying to get at there.
Okay. I think that's a really good point. I think that Paul would have made really profound distinctions and judged on certain things. What he's saying is, if we have a practice that is neutral in some way, then we need to not be holding one another in contempt or judging one another. But I don't think that all practices are neutral. And so I guess, and a big part of it is what we're bringing to it. So So if I'm in a group or if I have a friend who's doing a particular practice and is bringing this meaning to it, that this is what God expects of me, or I see them kind of working this out where I've got to do this so that God, and I see this a lot in people that I talk to, that you just kind of, I sense a pressure that, you know, I have to figure out what to do that's right. Well, I feel really free to talk about that and try to elucidate that there might be a misunderstanding of what grace is there. And Paul, for example, in the New Testament, was very firm with Peter when he was saying to the Judaizers or whoever, I don't remember the details, I'm so good at all these details, but you remember the story where Peter was saying, yeah, go ahead and do this stuff and it's okay. Paul said, no way, don't do it, because he saw it as indicative of this idea that they were trying to make the Christians be Jewish. And that was not okay with Paul because it didn't understand grace. So I think it is appropriate to make distinctions, and that's not what I'm trying to say. But on the other hand, I think we can assume a lot of stuff about people's practices, or if someone's practice looks like mine used to look when I was doing that, I can decide for them that that's what they're doing, and it might not be. So I think we need to just bear with one another and have conversations about it and understand it together, but really encourage one another to understand grace together. Is that helpful?
I was an atheist, going from having been raised as a Catholic, and about 16 I decided it was all a fairy tale. Had a lot in common with the story about Santa Claus, who also gave you lots of good stuff if you were good. Reasonable people didn't believe in Santa Claus, why would reasonable people believe in God? And so I spent 10 years, and then at the end of which became a Christian. And during that time, I also, as you know, have a background in biology and enjoy the outdoors. And I spent some time teaching in an environmental education school in Yosemite, which has got to be one of God's premier jewels that he created on the earth. And during that time, I was also doing the same thing. We have a lot in common. Doing the same thing whenever I'd run into a Christian.
We lived parallel lives,
yeah,
before we knew each other.
Exactly. Joined at the hip, we just didn't realize it.
Yeah.
Trying to find Christians and pin them against the wall and make idiots out of them, point problems with their perspectives. And one of the things that I would say in talking to them when they were saying, you know, not only do you need to be a Christian, but you need to be involved in a church and do all the worship stuff. And I can say, well, I feel much closer to God in the outdoors than I do in any church. And I actually have come to the perspective now where I sort of regret the stuff that has made me so allergic to formal worship, mm-hmm. because I have got so much baggage there that it's extremely difficult for me to appreciate. I mean, I'm beginning to get a glimmer, but I just go into this critical mode when I'm in that stuff, and all I can do is just find fault with it and criticize and pick it apart, and so it's a pain. But when I would talk to them about that, they would say, oh, no, you know, that's just a cop-out, you know, finding God in the outdoors. And I was just reflecting now as you were talking that there's a sense in which they're right and a sense in which they're wrong. Thursday night, there's a place I like to go at the end of Royal Avenue. It's a wildlife refuge, mm-hmm. and I go birding out there a lot, and sometimes I'll just stay out there, the sun will go down, and I'll look at stars, and it's
a great
just
spot.
A lovely, lovely place. And I got home after, left work late, it was already, the sun had gone down, I decided just to head out there, just for a little bit. And when I walked out there, it had been raining during the day, and then it was clearing, and I was almost out to where Fern Ridge, the water starts, and it's just lovely, just the song that you can hear, the night sounds, the frogs and the geese calling, and the air is really clean and cold because it's been raining, and now it's clear, a little bit of clouds, and the stars are just like little diamond chips in the sky, and And I'm just thinking, this is just so lovely, you know. It's almost like God kind of, I hadn't intended to go out there, it was kind of late, but I just went out there and gosh, it was just so, so pretty. And as I'm standing sort of looking towards the west, all of a sudden I hear this sound that sounds like I'm in the middle of a rainstorm. Like, all around me, the sound of drops falling and hitting the water, but it's not raining. And I looked up, and there were hundreds of ducks flying over me, and what I was hearing was their wing beats, but it sounded exactly like being in the middle of a rainstorm.
Wow.
And it was so lovely, and as I'm turning around, I look around, and there in the east, in these big chunky clouds, this huge full moon is rising and reflecting in the rain puddles in the path that I'm on. And I'm just thinking, this just is, it's like God saying, isn't this cool? Isn't this neat? You know, aren't you glad I brought you out here?
Yeah.
So I have that experience, and how the mundane, and actually this, it seems funny to call that mundane because it was actually
anything but
very
mundane. Huh?
Unmundane. It was mundane in that technically mundane means worldly, and this was based in the world, but it was just so exquisite. And God just kind of saying, pretty cool, huh? I did good here. But then so reflecting on that, I understand how that kind of thing can really, it's almost like God constructing loveliness. It almost, there was nobody else out there, loveliness for me, and I was looking at this. But I think the way in which the people that I was arguing with earlier, when I say I feel closer to God outside, was they recognized that while I was saying I feel closer to God outside than I do in a church, they recognized that I'm not really, at that point I wasn't really interested in finding God in the outdoors. I like being outdoors, but it was kind of a cop-out. I like everything else but God. I am not at that point prepared to say thank you, God, for this loveliness. It's my way of sort of trying to one up them. You know, look how advanced spiritually I am. Much more advanced than you. You need a church, but I can find God anywhere outside in nature. So I was just wondering if you have any reaction to that sort of idea that. It actually, I think, is along the lines of what you said with it's me and God, and it's you and God, and it's everybody else here and God. It's if you're going to cop out, you're going to cop out however you're going to cop out. You're going to cop out in the church, you're going to cop out outside. If you're connected with God, you're going to connect with Him at a church, you're going to connect with Him outside, you're going to connect with Him while you're scrubbing your bathroom floor, you're going to, I mean, it's just...
Because He's in charge of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really great. I guess the only thing I would add is that in terms of kind of judging each other's experiences or whatever, I think we do have to be careful because our subjectivity and our experiences go into making us so individual. And for another person who's trusting God and trying to figure this stuff out, they could have been there where you were and it might not have stirred them at all. And that's okay. I mean, it might have stirred them next month when the moon was at that space or, you know, whatever. But I wouldn't want that kind of thing to be prescriptive. And I think we can also get into mindset. This brings up another piece, which is that we can kind of try to understand, you know, I was thinking about Jack's description last night of our inwardness and our outwardness and how sometimes our outwardness is our emotions and we can be manipulated into feeling guilty or whatever. I think we could really drive ourselves crazy if we try too hard to distinguish. But I think that our lives, like David was saying too, that it's over time that we really see God at work and this inwardness expressing itself in that way. So I don't remember what that exactly had to do with what you were talking about, maybe nothing. But I guess just that some people might have a really the church experiences too, that we might have really big reactions to stuff that happened in church because I think that a lot of us have in common that we were really hurt by church experience on some level. And church experience I think can in fact be very hurtful to people, which is really unfortunate. really unfortunate. But given that that's true, that's another place I have to trust God for myself and for that other person who may not be able to walk into a church because of whatever's happened to them. But what I will see with them is the same softening toward God, the same understanding of my need for Him and my need for mercy, and the same desire for Him to, with His whatever tools He uses, to come in and chip away at the tartar of my life. It doesn't have to happen in a church. It can happen at the end of Royal Avenue. But I think there's also, in that sense, a reflection that God is the one that's in charge of this, and God can get us there. And it might look a lot of different ways over the course of our lives. There might be years that go by that I can't darken the door of a church. There might also be times that, in some people, I think, given their human experience of having been brutalized in other relationships by church, family, whatever, maybe are not going to have the same experience of joy that I do, or the same experience of God's love that I do. Does that invalidate my experience of God's love? No, but it does give me compassion for kind of recognizing, I think I need to be willing to recognize that not everybody might have that experience, and that even that is a gift to me, and that their gift is to bear something different, and that too is a gift to them, that even the absence of that is a gift that God can use to bring them to Him, to bring us to understand who God is. So I guess I just want to encourage us to be really broad in how we try to understand each other and care about each other. And that maybe speaks to your communal question as well. As we try to believe together and worship together, we really need to keep that in mind, that we all have really different backgrounds and experiences coming into it.
That kind of leads into what I've just been thinking about, choosing practices in the context of relationship with others. If we are married, or as in my case, courting, or have families, there's the choice of how to worship, or what to do, is complicated by the fact that there's more than just an individual to consider.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate the clarity of the individual devotional kind of thing, where when it's your individual practice in solitude, it's pretty much whatever has meaning for you. And but could you talk a little bit about choosing our worship, ways of worshiping, and how we defer to one another, or how those decisions, you kind of talked about it just now from the other end, I think, but how might we regard what means something to us, and at the same time
mm-hmm.
respect and regard and serve each other mm-hmm. in the way that we mm-hmm. defer to what is meaningful for them.
That's great. I think, like in relationships in life in general, not necessarily related to how we choose to worship, but how we choose to live together in marriages, especially. Marriage is this amazing that mill kind of grinding place where where God shows us who we are, and I think it's kind of an extension of maybe an idea that as we join our lives with another person and find out that they're really different than us, even though we were really in love with them and we thought we saw everything alike, but then we get married and find out that there's nothing alike about us in some ways. And that this is the challenge, really, of trying to learn how to love and be loving. And so I think similarly in our families, kind of being confronted with really different tastes and different styles that might be meaningful, I think what's important is that we communicate about what is meaningful about it to us, and know ourselves enough to share that with the other person, and also be willing to listen to what might be a really different experience from them so that we can know who they are. I mean, that's, I think, what it means to really know each other, is to listen on that level to one another. And I think that can happen inside of a marriage. I think it can also happen inside friendships, family relationships, church friend relationships, all those things. If we can learn how to listen to each other and communicate, and because, you know, almost everything that we do or like or something has a root somewhere. I mean, it's like I might not even know it for myself until I have the opportunity of a friend listening to me about it. And then as I talk about it, I go, oh, yeah, that's why that's so meaningful to me. And then I'm heard, and I'm supported, and I'm cared about. And so I have this experience with the Episcopal Church, because not very many of my friends like that stuff, and I go by myself pretty often. But I've had the experience where I have a friend who has come with me a few times, and I think there can be different ways that that happens. I think it's meaningful to her in a different way, and she actually grew up Episcopal, and so it's kind of a flashback for her, and it's something that's really powerful for her, and she loves it when we go. And it's really fun to have that experience. It's kind of like a gift, because we go together, and it's like, she's my Episcopal friend that I can kind of be there with, you know? And it's kind of fun. But then I have another friend who doesn't find that meaningful at all. Well, now, if that were my husband, who doesn't find it meaningful at all, or that he likes to do something that I don't really appreciate, it might be appropriate at some point that I give to him going along, because it's something I'm giving to him, not because I get it or see it the same way or need to, but because it's a gift that I'm giving to come along with them. So I think it can be a lot of different things. Does that make sense? Is that helpful? Okay.